portions of today's program are mechanically reproduced. And now keep your dial set on Channel 26 for the finest of television programming.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission.
Relief. You two take care of labor.
Only intended for a plane captain.
Danger! Danger! Man your stations! Vehicle in direct path of meteor storm!
You don't want to die of cold. Toll free.
Look, I'm a doctor, not an escalator. Spock, give me a hand.
I'll give you trouble!
Pop your piece around the track if you get...
Nails and more nails.
Have you ever tried to report a UFO sighting?
I'll save you the trouble. There is not a single government agency still in existence that will admit to any interest in the subject. If you seem to be insistent, they will refer you to a private organization.
You handsome, charming, specially marked boxes of monster cereals, no. Inside one of these free wax lips, fangs, or mustaches, they just uncover the real you.
We now continue with Smurf.
Steve Austin, astronaut, a man barely alive.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man.
The California mountains, there's a colony of aliens, explorers from deep space. They also control the Sasquatch.
Bigfoot?
That's right.
All funky colors. Shapes that swing.
It's impossible.
Robots? I call them fembots. The perfect women. Programmable, obedient, and as beautiful or as deadly as I choose to make them.
Alrighty. They're robots.
And now part two of Kill Oscar.
Run while you can, boss.
Welcome to Too Old First Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klink.
Yes, you are, David, and I am Troy Harkin. And hey, let's welcome everybody back to season 6 of Too Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. It's a season we're kind of calling Too Old Farts Meet the Glass Teat. And just for those of you who have not heard us talk about this, it's a special season for us. And many of you will be very familiar with the late, great sci-fi writer Harlan Ellison, who gave us the seminal works I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, Repent, Harlequin, Said the TikTok Man, A Boy and His Dog, and many other legendary and award-winning writings. In the late 60s, Ellison wrote an ongoing series of essays on television for the LA Free Press. And in those articles, he claimed that television had great potential, but tended to fall short of that potential. He wrote that TV didn't suck, rather, it was sucked like a giant breast, like a glass teat. Despite his often scathing critiques, Harlan Ellison continued to work in TV as a writer and script consultant. Ellison won an Emmy for his work on Star Trek, but he also contributed to The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Star Lost, Twilight Zone, and The Outer Limits. So this season, Too Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi has an all-TV season in mind, ergo Too Old Farts Meet the Glass Teat. Pardon me. Sorry, I'm doing okay. Dave, you are soldiering on with a little bit of an illness here. You are soldiering on like a Zuni warrior that you are.
Yeah, just with a touch of what is that thing? I think it's called COVID, which is my second bout of it. And I think I picked it up at the Buffalo NASFIC the previous weekend. It's still dangerous, I think, yeah. You know, meeting in crowds and doing stuff, but.
Yeah. I mean, you know, depending on who you talk to, some people say it can be life-threatening. Other people say it doesn't exist. So, you know, I am not one of those people. Anyway, our love of genre really did begin with television. Before we were old enough to read or even go to the theater, there was that omnipresent boob tube spewing out stories in glorious black and white, at least when we were kids, when we were wee ones.
Yep.
Yep. So we're covering some of the shows that we loved from that era, the era of the late 60s to early 80s, shows that were kind of a big deal, shows that had influence and are still well remembered by old farts like the two of us and hopefully by our listeners out there. And you know what, Dave? I was thinking recently, it's really funny how, you know, television was created with this idea, like the shows that we were watching when we were watching them, people had no sense that we would be talking about them 50 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they had no sense too that there would be physical media that would preserve these things that we could go back to, or streaming or YouTube, you know, all of these things that allow us to look back at these shows from a very specific era. So, I did not anticipate my dog barking. So today we're doing double duty, Dave.
Not only will we be examining the best ABC movies of the week, but we'll also be discussing the one, the only Richard Matheson, because it just so happens that he wrote three of the best movies of the week ever produced for the small screen. Let's get into it. Troy, you have the ball.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the history of ABC's movie of the week. In the era immediately prior to made-for-TV films, Hollywood's film studios gouged the television networks for the right to air newer films that had been theatrically released. And I can't even say theatrically today for some reason. Theatrically released. Television's answer to this gouging was to air older, cheaper films, but generally those were not during prime time. In the 1960s, both NBC and CBS had already produced one-off made-for-TV films. But it was ABC that came up with the idea of airing a full series of made-for-TV movies in a television series time slot, essentially updating the idea of an anthology series. And for folks who aren't totally aware, an anthology series is one where you've got a different story, different actors, different settings every week. And you know, shows like The Twilight Zone did that. What remained constant, but all of the other elements were changed up. So in one sense, the movie of the week functioned as an in-house pilot factory. If a film was well-received, the network could consider developing it into an ongoing series. This sort of testing ground gave Starsky and Hutch, The $6 Million Man, and Kung Fu life as an ongoing series. Now, movie of the weeks often dealt with hot-button issues, stories that were ripped from the headlines. So we got stories about hijackings, terrorism, motorcycle gangs, abortion, divorce, drug use, homosexuality, true crime, and later on, we'd get satanic panic films about Dungeons and Dragons. The ABC Movie of the Week debuted on September 23rd, 1969, with the film Seven in Darkness. Now, this was kind of a cool concept in itself. It was about a plane crash, and the survivors, for whatever reason, were all blind. And so you have the, you know, the standard, well, we've got plane crash and survivors, but they're blind as well. So you up the ante with that. Mm. By 1971, the ABC Movie of the Week was so successful, it was reaching 14 million viewers per week. ABC then added a Saturday Night Movie of the Week as well. Although the trend of network-created feature-length programming never really died, ABC pulled the plug on the Movie of the Week series on May 14th of 1975 as ratings declined. Now, I've got a list of a few films, and these are almost exclusively a part of the ABC Movie of the Week, but I have included a couple that were from other networks that were Movie of the Weeks that I think we all probably remember pretty well. One of the most famous ones was Brian's Song in 1971. Oh, yeah. And that was with James Caan and Billy Dee Williams.
Two football stars, rivals, best friends.
You and me, starting back, Bill, what do you say?
Brian Piccolo has cancer.
I'm not going to let it stop me.
I love you, Brian.
The story of Gail Sayers and Brian Piccolo. How they lived, how one died. Brian's song.
Yeah, and there's one that freaked me out that I think I might have mentioned in our blast-off episode, our premiere episode, which was called The Longest Night. And it was it came out in 72, starred David Janssen. And what was it was, again, a true story about this daughter of a millionaire who was kidnapped and then buried alive while the hijackers, or not hijackers, kidnappers were trying to negotiate a ransom. And that scared the hell out of me. That was the first time I'd ever dealt with the concept of premature burial as a child. That was like long before reading Poe. There was That Certain Summer in 1972 that starred Martin Sheen and Hal Holbrook. That was really the first mass media dealing with story dealing with homosexuality, and it still kind of boggles my mind to think that that came out in 72. So yeah, Kung Fu, as we mentioned, came out in 72 with David Carradine.
That one I did see, the original one. Like, I was watching those ABC movies of the week, and that was a stunt. That was a fantastic movie. I can see why they spun a series from it. So good.
The $6 Million Man, there were three made for TV movie pilots, and they were all successful, and they all, you know, sort of created a green light situation for the series. And that first one too, I remember the trailer for it that was on TV was so good. I saw it as a kid and I'm like, I've got to see this. This is a story about an astronaut and he crashes and he survives. And that was enough for me. I didn't even need bionics at that point. I just wanted to know what was going on. And we will, or actually at this point, we probably already have dealt with our bionic episode. And I hope you all enjoyed that. It was also, this one is just more of a footnote. Satan's School for Girls was released in 1973, and it had two angels in it, like before they were angels, Cheryl Ladd and Kate Jackson. And the tagline cracks me up, a perfect 666.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, Terror on the Beach was one of these movies of the week that was not on ABC. It was a CBS-produced movie of the week, and I think it came after the success of Dennis Weaver in Duel. But he played a father. Susan Day was one of his daughters. He takes his family on a vacation on the beach, and then they're harassed by hippies on motorcycles. Ooh, so scary. So scary. Also, speaking of scary, there was Killdozer in 1974 with Clint Walker and Robert Urich. I mean, that in itself is like, that should be a band name if it isn't already, you know, like Killdozer is perfect. And there's a website out there called jumpedtheshark.com. And they basically go through every TV series and they list the episode where the series jumped the shark, which we know comes from Happy Days and when Fonzie jumped the shark. So for the ABC movie of the week, they have the movie that jumped the shark was Killdozer. that was the point at which supposedly it was like, okay, yeah, we're done with this. And the last one I have here in our list of memorable movies of the week, although not all ABC movies of the week, is Salem's Lot from 1979. And that was with David Soul, Bonnie Bedelia, Lance Kerwin, James Mason. Super excellent, and maybe the last great movie of the week, although some will argue that technically it's a mini series as it aired on two nights. But it did screen in Europe as a single film, and that's the way you watch it. You watch it as a single film. It's not, anyway, whatever. Yeah, you know, haters gonna hate, right? Okay, are we ready to
Troy,
talk a little? Yeah.
Don't give up on us, baby.
I immediately thought of the actually the Peter Gabriel song, but that's the other one.
I had to go with David Soul because that was his big hit.
Oh yeah. That's it. Okay, I'm dropping that in there.
Don't give up on us, baby. Don't make that wrong seem right. The future isn't just one night. It's written in the moonlight. Painted on the stars. We can't change ours.
So yeah, let's I guess we should give a little bit of background on Richard Matheson as well, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
So what I wanted to say was that I came across the legacy of Richard Matheson little by little. After a while, it became clear that he had a body of work that was up there with any writer of the 20th century. Perhaps what obscured, you know, all of the work that he did was that it was spread out in multiple disciplines, short stories, novels, teleplays, screenplays, and just things that I didn't realize that he was responsible for. Because, you know, even though you get a couple seconds of screen time, you know, sometimes that doesn't cut it. It doesn't always stick with you, especially when you're younger. I first knew him as a writer for The Twilight Zone. And he didn't write as many scripts as Rod Serling, but his were some of the most memorable episodes, like Nightmare at 20,000 Feet with Shatner, Little Girl Lost, which went on to influence Poltergeist, Third from the Sun, which is just one of the all-time best Twilight Zone episodes, The Invaders with Agnes Moorehead, and like some of the other things we're going to look at today, they also featured like a one-person episode. And Steel, which you quite like Steel, right?
Yeah, I also liked, just a shout out, we already did a Twilight Zone episode, and Little Girl Lost. It was always cool because the one of the most important things in life is to actually have a friend that's a physicist. Because if you do, you can always call on them if there's some crack in your wall that leads to another dimension. You could just call them and they can help out. So that's handy.
That's right. And what's cool about that episode too is, you know, it feels like it's going to be paranormal, but then you realize no, it's really, this is a science fiction story, and because you know a physicist, you know, they can figure out how to crack that other dimension, how to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
All you need is like a protractor and a compass, I think, and you're good to go. Yeah.
And whatever they used back in the day, remember those slide rules, which my father tried to explain it to me. It was a triangle shape. You could slide certain things certain ways to be able to figure out. This is before calculators, really.
Right.
Hand calculators, pocket calculators.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
So Matheson's films include three adaptations of his novel, I Am Legend, including The Last Man on Earth, Omega Man, and I Am Legend. He also wrote the scripts for Somewhere in Time, The Incredible Shrinking Man, The Legend of Hell House, and What Dreams May Come, all based on his novels. And by the way, like this, I've had enough. Like when I hear this, it's like he published his first short story at age 8.
Wow.
Like that's just wrong. Stephen King has said that he was the first guy that I ever read who seemed to be doing something that Lovecraft wasn't doing. The horror could be in the 7-Eleven store down the block, or it could be just up the street. That was extremely exciting. He was putting the horror in places that I could relate to. And Steven Spielberg went as far as to say that for me, he is in the same category as Bradbury and Asimov. Richard Matheson was born in Allendale, New Jersey on February 20th, 1926, and he passed away June 23rd, 2013. And David, with that, I think we're ready to jump into our first three, well, not first three, our three movies of the week by Richard Matheson for today's show.
Oh, absolutely. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while. We've been talking about doing a Richard Matheson when we even created, before we even did our first episode. He was on the list of, you know, we wanted to get to him. And okay, it's season 6, but we finally got to Richard Matheson.
Well, there's just so much out there. Like, that's the amazing thing. You know, there's so much. I was even like, you know, looking ahead to you know, us getting to 100 episodes. Mm. And you realize at this point, that's roughly, you know, 30 to 25 to go. And, you know, you're still leaving out a ton of stuff. Mm. I wanted to mention, we should let people hear. Clearly, they can't see the opening. Well, you know what? Actually, if they go to YouTube, they can find the opening for the ABC movie of the week from 1969. And it was really cool because it was actually animated by Douglas Trumbull. And it's based on the work that he did for 2001. You know, during the, Dave, you may know the proper name for this, but the sort of psychedelic experience that Dave Bowman has, you know, it lasts for like 5 minutes on screen, I think, in 2001. But the opening credits use the same mirror effect, that look quite cool. And, the opening it sounds amazing. But also, I found out today, Dick Tufeld, the voice of the B9 robot from Lost in Space, did the opening voiceover for the ABC movie of the week. So it's funny how we already have like genre connections with this. So let's just have a quick listen. And if you want, you can check it out on YouTube.
Movie of the Week. Presenting the world premiere of an original motion picture produced especially for ABC. Tonight on the Movie of the Week.
So for Duel, it aired November 13th, 1971, 74 minutes, starring Dennis Weaver. The screenplay was written by Richard Matheson and based on his own short story. Matheson dated the origin of Duel back to an actual incident where he and a friend were chased by a crazed truck driver on November 11th, 1963, the day Kennedy was assassinated. Matheson's original short story was published in the April 1971 edition of Playboy. Duel happened to be the last short story Matheson ever wrote. He would concentrate on scripts and novels.
It's about time, Charlie. You want me to hit that car head on?
Dennis Weaver.
Okay, Jack, I've had it. Why? Why is he doing this?
The story of our terrorized driver, David Mann, stars Dennis Weaver, as you have mentioned, in what is basically a one-man show as he tries to escape the wrath of an insane truck driver. Or is it an insane truck? Now, David and I recently watched the European theatrical cut, in which there are a couple of brief glimpses of a human driver. But it seems that in the original televised movie of the week, the original version that aired, you never see a driver at all. And I just, from what I have read, I picked up the book, The ABC Movie of the Week Companion by Michael Carroll. And I suggest you all do the same if you are interested in this topic. He also mentions, like, you don't see the driver or you didn't see the driver in the original. So I'm assuming it was just cut differently for the European audience and for the theatrical version. Anyway, we literally get a story of man versus machine. And Spielberg, you know, talked about not being very subtle as often, you know, when we're younger creators, we aren't as subtle as we become later on in life as we mature. So yeah, he you know, called his protagonist, David Mann. Weaver's performance is nuanced and nerve-wracking, and predominantly it is done without dialogue. We have a few exceptions where Spielberg utilizes voiceover to convey David Mann's anxiety-drenched inner monologue. But when we get back into his Plymouth Valiant, The chase resumes. It's mostly wordless, white knuckle action. But why don't we check out some of that voiceover, like when he goes into Chuck's cafe, David?
I don't know. All I did was pass this stupid rig a couple of times and he goes flying off the deep end. He has to be crazy. Okay, so he's crazy. What can I do about it? Find him a psychiatrist? Oh, boy. Why didn't I leave right away when I saw his truck outside? Then I'd know what he intends to do. What if he followed me out, though? Started after me again? I'd be right back where I started. Even if I got a lead, he'd overtake me soon enough. He's got some souped-up diesel. My car's just not that powerful. I just can't drive 80 and 90 miles an hour. As soon as I stop concentrating, I'd go back to 60 or 70 like I always do. It's a habit. I can't help it. He's just like... Take it easy. Just take it easy.
I maybe shouldn't have been surprised to find out that Chuck's Cafe was an actual place.
Actually, yeah, and I just watched something on Richard Matheson, and he had visited the set, and he was there in the cafe. He thought it was a real cafe. Well, it was, but he thought all the people that were in the cafe were people just in the cafe. It turns out all of them, of course, were actors, but they just seemed so real to him. And I think also in this interview I saw, part of that whole cafe sequence and everything that was done, it was more than what was in the story that was in Playboy, because they needed to fill a bit of time because it was going to run a bit short for the televised film. And I think what they added there was very good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I'm always impressed by just how good this film is. Hmm. I don't know how many times I've seen it now, but I'm guessing it's probably pushing 10. And I'm never, you know, not anxious when I watch it. It's so intense. And we have to remember that this is essentially Steven Spielberg's first film. Yes, it was made for television, but it is structured as a feature film, and it played in Europe as a theatrical release. We also have to remember just how good this thing is, how quickly it was made. Duel is shot in 13 days. Once shooting was completed, he had 3 weeks prior to air to edit the film. And so he has talked about how the editing was split between 5 different editors who cut separate sections of the film while Spielberg biked between editing locations to okay the work.
And wow.
And I mean, that's a crazy story in itself, but the fact that I visualize Steven Spielberg like Elliot on his bike, you know, maybe without E.T. on the bike, but, you know, biking around. I'm pretty sure they had golf carts back in 1971. I don't know why he was biking around the, you know, the back lots doing this, but hey, that's the way Steve tells it. So I can go with that. This is something I learned from some research, David, that on the front grill of the Peterbilt, we see there are more than a half dozen license plates. Spielberg says the idea was that these are the notches in its belt. These are from other cars that the Peterbilt has destroyed. And that's a cool idea that I certainly wouldn't have just picked up on, you know, but I love the fact that he included that.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that either. Like, even when we watched this film, like, thanks for inviting me up to your place in Aurora. It was very nice. We spent the day watching a lot of the Richard Matheson stuff. And you're right, the front of it has all the, and I was wondering what's going,
yeah.
You normally don't have a whole bunch of license plates stuck to the front of your truck.
Yeah, and it's the same thing crossed my mind, but I never really, you know, pursued it. It was just like, what's with all the license plates? Yeah, and then it's just creepy to realize, oh, shit, he's done this many, many times, or the truck has, whatever. I just have a little note that we should probably talk about the reptile scene too. How intense that is. And it's funny because it's, I have to assume that Spielberg also has a thing about spiders and snakes, because in this one scene, Dennis Weaver pulls over and it's like this, what did they call it? Like a reptile museum or something. And this woman with her little gas bar also has like these in little chicken wire cages, various reptiles and spiders as well. And then the truck comes back to get him. Dennis Weaver's trying to call the cops to report this guy, and the thing heads right towards the phone booth.
I'll have to give you the police, sir.
Right, well, give me the police.
Sir, which department do you want?
Whichever's closer.
What number are you calling from?
This number is 9821. David Mann.
How do you spell that, please?
M-A-N-N. That's two N's. I'd like to report a truck driver that's been endangering my life.
He has to jump out, but it takes out all of these cages, releasing the spiders and snakes. And so, I immediately think of Indiana Jones, right?
Yes.
Like, why did it have to be, what is it, the spiders? Yeah. And there's the snake in the cockpit too.
Yeah, it's almost in a, like he learned to work with, obviously there'd be a pet wrangler on set, a reptile wrangler, and he got the experience from working with that to be able to continue that. And also all those great shots of moving vehicles, because you see that a lot of the Indiana Jones movies with the trucks and the shots up and from sides. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny now that you mention that too, that truck, the one where Indy ends up going, out the window, out the front window, and then he crawls underneath, like that great classic scene.
Yeah.
That probably does owe a lot to Duel, both in terms of experience and just the way it was shot. Mm. And let's talk about the way this thing sounds, the way this movie sounds, both in terms of music and sound effects.
And you just get it as you're watching it, because I did also watch a documentary talking to Richard Matheson talking about it, that basically with the sound, a lot of it was just the sound of the truck, the sound of the car, the sound of the highway, and all of that. In other words, bits of the music, but the music almost sounded like it was underscoring or in addition to those sounds, as opposed to some melodic thing that makes you feel more at ease or whatever. Music can add to the tension, and that's something that I think Spielberg picked up on and used in basically every film he's done. And like Jaws is a perfect example also, that this one, there was that menacing kind of sound running through it that almost sounded a bit mechanical.
Yeah. And you and I, there was one point in the film where you and I both looked at each other and we commented how we thought it sounded a little bit like Jerry Goldsmith's original Planet of the Apes, which utilized like organic instruments like ram horns and whatnot. Mm. It definitely had that very primitive quality that is not, orchestration. And for me, like I would love to see how they put together the audio for this film, because, dealing with wind is very difficult, when you're shooting. So I always wonder how much of it was done. I mean, I know it was done after the fact. I know it was probably Foley and added later, but man, it sounds so good. Like if you just don't watch this film, if you look down and listen to it, you're convinced you're in a vehicle, and this is like the bulk of the film. You don't have, dialogue, but you almost get like the dialogue between the two vehicles, the sound of the two vehicles talking to one another. And I'll pass it on to folks now that Duel won a 1972 Emmy for Outstanding Achievement in Film Sound Editing. This film could be very bad, and it could suffer the worst fate of any film like this. It could be boring, but what keeps it from being boring is, well, the editing, but even just the sound of it. Like, it sounds so good. While we're talking about awards, I will also say that Duel was nominated for a 1972 Golden Globe for Best Movie Made for TV. And another thing that I wanted to throw out, well, actually, let's talk about the finale of the film a little bit too. Mm. So as the movie heads towards its finale, Weaver pushes his dying Plymouth up this massive incline with the truck hot on his bumper, and then he reaches the apex and is forced to glide. Oh, the issue here is that we've been told a couple of times that he needed to replace the radiator hose. Yeah. And you know, the first time he's told, he thinks that he's being sold a bill of goods type of thing.
Of course, yes.
But and then the second time he's told it is at the reptile farm, and he actually does want to replace it, but then all hell breaks loose and he doesn't get a chance to replace it. And then we see the payoff where the thing starts overheating like crazy as he's going up this huge incline. Then he reaches the apex. He's forced to glide down the side of the mountain without using the brake until he reaches the canyon and the climax of the film. So basically, he sets it up so, spoiler alert, so that the truck forces his car off this cliff into this canyon, and both vehicles are done. They're toast. Now, the studio was pissed off that Spielberg didn't blow up the truck, and they wanted him to go back and reshoot the climax with the truck blowing up, but he refused to do it. Mm. Spielberg thought this ending with the slow, agonized death of the truck was better, and he was right. I love the shot in the interior of the cab where we see something dripping from the steering wheel, and like I said it out loud too as we were watching, is that blood? Is it oil? Mm. What is it? And it's great that you don't know, but you get the sense either way that it's losing its life essence. It is dying. And it's a perfect sequence, and we would have been robbed of that had the thing just blown up. Mm. And again, we do not see a driver. We don't see like a hand or a boot or whatever. But we do get this death groan that we hear at the end of Duel as the Peterbilt goes over the cliff and then is dying. And so Spielberg decided that when he did Jaws and after the shark is blown up, and we see the remnants of the sharks going to the bottom of the ocean, he wanted to use that exact same Foley from Duel, that sound effect of this like mechanical kind of. And I thought that was brilliant that he did that, even though, I mean, you know, the shark is a monster. It's not mechanical, but it's a monster. Anyway, what a ride, eh, Dave?
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to get in was the fiction, because with Duel, which appeared in Playboy, I'm also in another podcast with Rachel A. Rosen called Wizards and Spaceships, and we're going to be doing an episode on how you begin a story. And there's someone who does a podcast on that. So at the very beginning, the very first line is at 11:32 a.m., man passed the truck.
That's great. And
that's already set up.
Yeah.
The whole thing. And then he gets into a description. He was heading west. It's hot. Describing how he's got his tie undone, how he's sweating, and how, and for the past 20 years, he'd not seen another vehicle. So that also gives you a sense that this is going to be a one-on-one. Like this, you know, if it's the only vehicle on the road and it's having an issue with you, you're in a bit of trouble.
Yeah. And it is a great opener too, because, and even with the time, sort of like, it's like a timestamp. It's like also like some legal document. Like, you know that this something is going to happen here, and we know it's important that we know, you know, the beginning of something's happening here. And it's
absolutely.
Anyway, should we move on to our second movie of the week by Mr. Richard Matheson?
Tuesday Movie of the Week. Presenting the world premiere of an original motion picture produced especially for ABC.
May I introduce myself? My name is Kolchak of the Daily Chronicle.
Kolchak reports the bizarre, the supernatural, the unexplainable.
You again in another crazy story.
This nut thinks he is a vampire.
You know what I call that? Irresponsible yellow journalism.
He has killed four, maybe five women.
I saw that so-called super killer wipe up the streets with your so-called police force.
They don't want any help from amateur bloodhounds like you.
I've been a reporter for 22 years.
I've been a police officer for 30.
Well, then why don't you retire?
Each man in the field has been issued one of these. And one of these.
Are you suggesting that we pound one of these into Skorzeny's chest?
No, into his heart.
Darren McGavin, the Night Stalker.
ABC presents Tuesday Movie of the Week.
Let's just say I've seen this and its sequel. Like, there were two movie of the weeks that dealt with Carl Kolchak. There was The Night Stalker and The Night Strangler, and Rob Sawyer, my brother-in-law, and my sister Carolyn, they would invite me over and we would watch these films, which still stand up today.
Yeah, they really do. And it's funny, now I know, and I think most people do know who are fans of The X-Files, know how Kolchak ended up being the influence for The X-Files and all of the other Chris Carter shows. But at the time The X-Files was on, one of the things that I loved was the lack of light, the darkness, and the way it was done. And I remember thinking, oh, well, you know, we've got modern cameras now that can shoot in extremely low light. And I love it. I love that we can do this. But I was surprised when we watched The Night Stalker, how those scenes in the sort of climax of the story in the house of the vampire, how low lit they were and how atmospheric it really was, especially for a TV movie. Like, it really is atmospheric, and there's a lot of like backlit stuff, and it really, like, I could actually even more see the influence of Night Stalker on The X-Files at that point, because previous to that I just thought of it in terms of, oh, here's a guy who's trying to find the truth, just like Mulder, right? And and we have, like, we get later on in the Kolchak series, we get these sort of monster of the week stories like we do in X-Files. So I was thinking it was more like a story influence, but it's not. It's also like a visual influence. Like all of us, I think Chris Carter was really taken aback with you know, how good those Matheson scripts were, and how Darren McGavin's performance, how good it was. Also, you know, another thing that we get with Darren McGavin's performance that we can see in Fox Mulder is, yes, he's very serious about his work, but there's also a sense of humor that is there as well. Anyway, that's my blurb about that. But do you want to tell us who was in this thing, David?
Well, let's start with it. So the Night Stalker first aired on January 11th, 1972, 74-minute teleplay, of course, Richard Matheson, produced by Dan Curtis. Now, it starred Darren McGavin as Carl Kolchak. And you had mentioned, you had found this out about how Darren McGavin was actually in one of the pilots for the $6 Million Man.
That's right. And they called him, he basically played the Oscar Goldman part, but he, his name in the original was Oliver Spencer. And as sort of a sidebar to that, I found it weird that when they did the Night Strangler, the second night, the second Kolchak movie of the week, Richard Anderson, who played Oscar Goldman in the series, he was in the Night Strangler. So it's weird that he's in that, and then Darren McGavin was in the $6 Million Man pilot. So it's like just this weird crossover of reality. But you also talked about how much you loved Simon Oakland as Tony Vincenzo.
Yeah, this is one of those things where, and I love the series too, because there was also after these ABC, you know, movie of the weeks. And which were, this was the, one of the great concepts ever, because they actually had these things. Almost each one was like a pilot. So that you've already got the work. You've already see what works. You already know what you can fiddle with. And if you get the go ahead, the green light, then it turns into a series. And you've already got like things like Starsky and Hutch and a whole bunch of, there were just so many $6 Million Man and so on. There was just a bunch that were, I think the Snoop Sisters was a series. And I think that there was an ABC movie of the week that had Mildred Natwick and Helen Hayes. And I think that was one that launched the series of Snoop Sisters. So there's it was just the smartest thing you could possibly do. Now with Simon Oakland, anything that has him, Tony Vincenzo and Carl Kolchak at each other's throats, arguing and him losing his temper and Kolchak leaving the office before he's fired. It works so wonderfully that you look forward to those dust-ups and those arguments and those conversations, because it's just, you know, it's such a high selling point. Plus, you've got just the almost, I don't know what is, deep-set empathy or something?
Did I say it was a vampire?
Well, what does your suggested headline say?
The story makes it clear.
Vampire killer in Las Vegas, ? Do I misread?
The story makes it clear.
Do I misread, or did you use the word vampire?
Some screwball who imagines he's a vampire is loose in Las Vegas, and people ought to be told.
If there's a screwball running around loose in Las Vegas, his last name begins with a K.
Darren McGavin from Christmas Story and from the Kolchak and everything else is maybe one of the most likable.
Yeah.
Someone you just want to hang out with, have a beer, talk about, you know, scooping some story, whatever it is. Like him as a perfect reporter with the straw hat, the seersucker suit, looking the same disheveled guy, somehow this and it's such a nice guy that someone, you know, people can fall for it, like Carol Lindley. That's the one thing I've been I'll finish the list of people in a second. But that's one of the things I didn't appreciate at the very ending of that film was the idea that they're going to make them both leave town, but they're going to do it separately. And it's not like today where you have a cell phone, you have ways of being able to connect with someone. They get her out of town. They don't tell where she went. He's kicked out of town and he's trying to connect with her because they have such a great connection yet. And then he's doing all this reporter stuff and trying to find out or figure out where she is. That wouldn't happen nowadays.
Right.
But for them, that's really cruel because they could have said, okay, you're both leaving. Approach them both together. Have them both into the office. By the way, this is the arrangement. If you don't leave, we're going to charge you with the murder of the vampire. And now, and you can both leave. And then they can decide at that point, well, we'll leave together and we'll go off to wherever. And I thought that was particular. I didn't even pick it up until I saw it at your place a week or two ago. That was really cruel because they did that intentionally.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, let me just.
Sorry. Let me just interject there too.
Yeah.
You made me think of something that I meant to mention during Duel. One of the things that I find, so clearly Duel and all of these were produced at a time prior to cell phones. And one of the things that's really difficult as a writer nowadays is that we live in a world with cell phones. Mm. So many stories from the past, you know, they don't happen if you have a cell phone. And unless you create, you then have to go through the machinations of like, oh, I lost my cell phone. Oh, I don't have enough power. You have
no to do signal
something to get rid of your right to yeah. negate that. But when I was watching Duel this time, I find it even more nerve wracking because you go, oh my God, he has no phone. You know, he has no cell phone because our instinct as a modern viewer is just pull over and call the cops, pull over and like text somebody. And it's like, well, fuck, he has no phone. You know, he has to go to the reptile place to use the
pay phone.
And then that doesn't work out. So,
well, as a sidebar, finish your point.
Well, that's basically it. It's like, sometimes I find watching older things even more intense.
Yeah.
Like it makes it even better, like because you have the built-in thing of like, oh, use your cell phone. Oh no, they have no cell phone. Yeah, I wanted to mention with Simon Oakland too before we get on to the rest of the cast, how if you grew up when we did, like you knew this guy's face.
Because
he was one of those character actors that, you know, we now refer to as that guy because you've seen him in so many things and you probably don't know his name. I forgot his name. But so here's just a quick list of some of the things that he was in: Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Star Lost, Charlie's Angels, Hawaii Five-O, Chips, Quincy, Kojak. He was even on The Littlest Hobo, which is a Canadian show about a German shepherd saving people here and there. Anyway, let's go on, Dave.
Yeah, Claude Akins, always like him, Sheriff Butcher. And he also played General Aldo on Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Yes, and at some point we need to pick up the rest of the Planet of the Apes films of the original five and talk again with Rob because we know how much he loves. That's Rob Sawyer. We know how much he loves Planet of the Apes.
He's our first guest host. I think it's either episode 2 or 3 of our very first season. Yeah. Carol Lindley is Gail Foster. And yep. You mentioned a note about Bunny Lake is missing. So that may have been a film that she was in.
It is. And it's funny. It's one I haven't seen, but once I read up a little bit about it, I thought I need to see this film because I'm a huge Big Lebowski fan. And just the title sounds like it must have been inspired the Big Lebowski. I don't know if that's true or not. And we got somebody else from the MASH universe, right, David?
Yeah, it was neat watching it again and just noting Larry Linville, who was Frank Burns in MASH, who was the coroner. He seemed great. He was, it's sort of almost his character type. It's sort of, you know, that person who you don't think a joke would work on kind of thing.
Right. And hey, maybe after he, you know, left the Korean War, maybe he became a coroner in Las Vegas.
It's possible. Barry Atwater as Jason Scorzani, who I can't remember the stuff, but Barry Atwater as a name sounds very familiar. I think he was probably like Simon Oakland, just in a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, he was... you know, so good as this vampire. Like, you know, I think it's not easy to be skulking around without a lot of dialogue and not be funny. And he isn't. He's very good. He's very believable vampire.
Yeah. And it's again goes back to Richard Matheson in the script, because everything in this whole film leads towards an investigation. It's like something where they're trying to narrow down and figure stuff out, and each news conference is larger and has more people. And it just makes sense. You can believe this is actually happening.
Yep. And so this was one of the highest rated movies of the week ever. And it led to the second movie of the week, The Night Strangler, set in Seattle. And we may get into that at some point too, because I'm sure we will want to talk about the series itself at a future date. So we might, you know, look back on that one. I like anything set in old Vegas, in the Fremont Street Vegas era, and not the the modern strip. It's just so cool to see these films like Viva Las Vegas. And anyway, just to see Carl Kolchak driving along and passing like the dunes and the sands and the Golden Nugget and stuff like that.
And yeah, it's also, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say it's Vegas is a really neat city, right? For when you're thinking of vampires, because A, it's a city all about the nightlife. And it's also really, when you think of it as a city set in a desert, well, what's a desert, but sort of like a dead zone, right? It's like death itself. So it's a perfect vampire milieu.
Yeah. And the other thing, I think anyone who wants to do a screenwriter to basically write and have an understanding of how a film works, this would be a very useful one to watch. And I think it excels the highest beyond just, Darren McGavin, what he does, the voiceover, like when he is driving along and you hear Darren McGavin's voice of him thinking and talking about this is so tight, how so smart and works absolutely perfect. I don't know if there's any example of a voiceover that works better than this film.
Well, I think we need to hear a sample of the dulcet tones of Darren McGavin now.
So all the loose ends have been gathered together and tied into a pretty knot right around the neck of guess who. After I left town, I began putting notices in the personal columns of newspapers from San Francisco to St. Louis. Until I run out of money, that is. So far, I've received no answers, but I'll keep trying, even though I don't think I'll ever find Gail Foster again. Maybe it's just as well. So that's it. The book's finished. And now you'll have to judge for yourself. I must warn you, however, if you try to verify this account, you will find it quite impossible. Item, in Washington, D.C., there was no longer a file listing the suspect under his true name or any of his alleged aliases. Item, in Las Vegas, all of those who were involved have either left town, aren't talking, or are dead. I haven't had a decent night's sleep since all this happened. And now you might find it difficult, too. Because there is still one fact that cannot be buried. After the death of Janos Skorzeny, he and all of his victims were immediately cremated. Why? Remember the legend? All those who die from the bite of the vampire will return as a vampire, unless destroyed first. So think about it and try to tell yourself, wherever you may be, in the quiet of your home, in the safety of your bed, try to tell yourself it couldn't happen here.
So like all of these movies of the week, they're shot on a really tight schedule. Night Stalker was 12 days. I find like having the tight budget, the tight schedule, it makes having an end product like The Night Stalker and Duel and Trilogy of Terror even more impressive, you know, because it shows what you can do with certain limitations. You know, it's not going to work all the time, but these are certainly examples where it does. I also, I had a note about the crazy jazz theme during the pool fight. With the cops and the vampire, just something it's so of its time. Like I would love to see this now with certain things. Just put this crazy like freeform jazz going on while there's a fight. Like it just doesn't happen anymore.
Well, it works perfectly for that scene. Mm-hmm. It's off-putting. It's upsetting. It's just underscores the violence. It's like the music that was done in Duel. It works so well. You think, why would they do that? Well, watch and listen, and you'll see how that works perfectly. I mean, that whole scene where he gets shot that number of times, and then he actually gets away. And just the set, we feel exactly the same way as Kolchak and those police officers. We're thinking, what the F? This guy has just gotten shot this number of times and he's going away. And this, you almost feel relief for a second. Like, okay, what just happened? One, and two, thank God he didn't stick around because he could have finished us off.
Yeah.
Incredible moment.
This is probably a good point to mention a little note on Dan Curtis, because Dan Curtis produced The Night Stalker and The Night Strangler. But he certainly had sort of this vibe going for vampire stories. He created the gothic soap opera Dark Shadows for ABC, and he directed three Dark Shadows feature films. He produced the two Kolchak films, and he directed Trilogy of Terror. So that sort of also is a good segue for us into Trilogy of Terror. Unless you had anything else you wanted to mention about Kolchak, The Night Stalker.
Well, definitely we're going to have to do episodes perhaps next season on The Night Stalker. And Rob is a huge, huge fan. My brother-in-law Rob, sorry, is a huge fan of the Night Stalker series. I have to watch a lot of them again, and I feel that these movies are so strong. And certainly we have pushed that first one, but the second one, because you always think there's, it's just not going to be as good. Like The Night Stalker is incredible, and then there's a Night Strangler. The Night Strangler is a very strong film. And maybe it's not quite at the same level, but if this is an 8.8, it might be an 8.1 kind of thing. Like, it's still
incredible. Yes. It's really good. I mean, like I said, I learned a lot about Seattle. I thought it was kind of cool that they set it there and that there's this, you know, this sort of ancient underground Seattle that still can be accessed. But, you know, really, you realize once you start to see the series, which I loved as a kid, and I still enjoy watching, but it definitely is not as strong as the two movies of the week. And that is to do with the absence of Dan Curtis and the absence of Richard Matheson, who, you know, they weren't involved with the series. So we are left with sort of the wonderful on-screen watchability of Darren McGavin and Simon Oakland through the series, and not a lot more. But oh, I did want to mention as well, David, that I learned today that it was McGavin who came up with the look of Carl Kolchak.
Oh, okay.
Like he showed up wearing this stuff, and they thought it was perfect, and he thought like that was his vision for the character. Anyway, let's go on to our third and final example of great movies of the week by Richard Matheson, shall we?
Absolutely.
All right. Did you want to give us a little background on Trilogy of Terror?
Yeah, this is something that people of our age remember. We all watched it. We all sort of hone in on the final one, the third of the three acts, remember parts of it, remember the ending of it. And it's something that affected all of us. And it's certainly, I think, one of the things where horror does its best work. So Trilogy of Terror aired Tuesday, March 4th, 1975, directed by Dan Curtis. Karen Black, and this is the cool thing, plays all four leading roles. There were three basic stories, which is why, of course, it's a trilogy. There are three stories. And the stories were named based on the people. Julie was the first one. The second story dealt with two characters. I believe they were listed as sisters, Millicent and Therese. And the final one, which is the one that we all think about, Amelia. And of course, this is the one where we've seen Richard Matheson talk about it, how, yes, he wrote all three stories, but he wanted to write the screenplay specifically for the third one, because he knew that was the gem. That was the one, which is why it was also presented third. You bring the best for last. And with him doing the screenplay of his own story meant that it was his vision throughout. So do you want to go over the Julie story?
Sure. So the first story, Julie, is the story of an apparently virginal university English professor who is sadistically entrapped by one of her students. But it turns out Professor Julie turns the tables on the fiend. It has a real EC Comics vibe to it. And a nice sort of twist ending that you don't see coming, which I won't entirely ruin here. But there is a scene where the student, who we were told in the commentary by Karen Black, that the student is played by her, was it her husband, Dave, or a boyfriend at the time? One of the two, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was a boyfriend, I think.
Yeah, she wasn't going to accept the part if he didn't play it. Mm. Anyway, so there's a drive-in scene that features footage from the original Night Stalker movie, which I thought was really cool. And I didn't know when we watched it, I wasn't sure if that had been added because it almost looked a little green screen to me. Mm. But and supposedly that's the way it originally aired too, which I thought was quite cool. And I guess a little in joke by Dan Curtis to throw that in there.
I'll go into Millicent and Therese, sure, if that's okay.
Sure.
Explores the Apollonian Dionysian relationship between two adults. And this is almost the perfect thing because, again, you've got one, sisters can be very different. Well, I'm not sure if they can be more different than these two sisters. One is a bookish spinster, Millicent. And then there is the hottie dressed in a precursor of the Hooters uniform, Therese. And what's really cool is this is the same actress. This is Karen Black. Like this whole trilogy of terror, we have to give a shout out to Karen Black and how great she is as an actress. It's just amazing what she's able to do in these trilogy.
And it was a great idea to have her, take on all the parts, because it's, you don't get that often, and usually it's like a talent like Peter Sellers in Doctor Strangelove.
I was just going to say that with the gothic parlor tales implying sexual deviance or impropriety were big in the late 1960s and early 70s, and Dark Shadows, of course, and the popularity of gothic paperbacks were prime examples of this sort of thing. So this basically fits in perfectly with that milieu.
Yeah, yeah, and you have, they're hanging out in this mansion, which I guess we didn't mention. And I remember so many of those paperbacks from that era, and there, how many variations they came up with of sort of a damsel with like the torn bodice in the foreground, looking over her shoulder back at a castle or mansion or some sort of gothic structure, like that was the basis for so many paperback sales of that genre in the like late 60s and probably early 70s until, paperbacks got a more stripped down approach. Like Jaws comes to mind, like the famous, the Jaws movie poster was based on the Jaws paperback, the hardcover as well of the shark, the face of the shark going up towards the female swimmer at the top of the page. And then we sort of had a different, stripped down imagery for paperback sales or book sales in general.
The funeral is over and I am alone in the house. Therese is out cavorting with one of her men. On this night when father is barely cold in his casket, I ran some old family films to remind myself of when it began. Even then, at 12, she was already using her wiles on him. Poor mother, so weak, so innocent, never suspecting the depth of evil in Therese. My spoiled sister. Her sweet little face never fooled me for an instant. I knew the darkness behind it. I knew the fermenting ugliness in her soul.
And well, then we get into the third, and the big one. And it, you know, I find I like the first two. Like I always think it when I go back to Trilogy of Terror that I'm not going to enjoy the first two, but I do. And it's very much like, it reminds me of how when you go see a band and if the band's any good, they've chosen a couple of good opening bands. And to me, that's what this is like. Like the first two are enjoyable. They're nowhere as good as Amelia. But that's not why we came. We all know we came to see Amelia, you know, after your first viewing of it. Yeah, that's the vibe I got of it. Two decent opening bands and then a great headlining band. So Amelia is based on Matheson's short story Prey, which appeared in the April 1969 edition of Playboy magazine. Amelia is a young woman who is torn between her mother, who wants her to return home, and her boyfriend, Arthur Breslow, who we are told is a professor. Amelia has bought a 2-foot Zuni fetish doll for her anthropologist boyfriend. And if you have not seen this thing, I mean, it is iconic, but it has these gruesome, sharp, razor-like teeth, a vicious scowl, and is holding what we're told is a very sharp spear. Once we get a couple of scenes, a phone call, chit-chat taken care of, all hell breaks loose as the Zuni fetish doll comes to life and chases Amelia around her apartment. The remainder of the segment is classic. I rewatched some of it just to time it today. The whole segment is 23 minutes and 35 seconds long. And it's at the 9:30 point of the episode where Amelia puts the stake. Oh, actually, this is what I call unintended horror, by the way, David, where Amelia puts the stake on a cooking pan with her bare hands and then grabs the salt and pepper without washing her hands. And I was like, no, you've got to wash your hands first. Anyway, slightly after that, the 10-minute mark, she realizes the doll is gone. And at the 10:30 point, she is stabbed under the couch. So we have 3 minutes of suspense where we're wondering where the doll has gone. And then at the 13:30 point, she's stabbed again, and we see the doll on camera alive. So the remainder of this episode is this thing coming at her. It is partly hilarious, partly exhilarating, and equally nightmarishly terrifying. The doll always strikes me as a mix of Speedy Gonzales if he was a fast-moving zombie, and the Tasmanian devil if he was possessed by Pazuzu. you want to both scream and laugh at the same time, and it really is like a roller coaster ride that way. And it's just so iconic. It's essentially the length of a Twilight Zone episode, and that helps it sustain its manic energy. Perhaps, you know, like few other things broadcast on television pre-streaming, this segment has made an indelible impression on the minds and memories of those that saw it. Do you remember the first time you saw it, Dave?
Oh, yeah. I think it would have been when it was first broadcast. We were watching the ABC movie of the week, just as a family.
Yeah.
And let's just say that was kind of anyone I've talked to about it, that's what they remember.
Yeah. Well, you were here when we were talking to it with somebody who was doing some work for us, and we mentioned it, and she like immediately, like, you know, went back to however old she was as a child and like the details of it. And, you know, adults had water cooler conversations, but as children, we had recess discussions. And Trilogy of Terror was one of those major moments that I remember standing outside in the schoolyard at recess and going, "Did you see that thing with the doll last night?" And like you said, it was a movie of the week. Mm. So the thing about the movies of the week was, you know, as Forrest Gump says, it really was like a box of chocolates, because you didn't know what you were going to get, really, right? Mm. Like, there'd be a trailer beforehand, but or a little ad for it. But every week it could be a different thing. It wasn't like, you know, you always had a story about a doll chasing you around. You know, you could have had like this football story, this sentimental, touching football story, you know, or a story about a bionic man, you know, or this crazy story, either about a truck chasing you or a little Zuni fetish doll. Yeah, dolls are freaking scary.
Yeah, especially if you find a doll in a cornfield. But sorry, I've gone too far. Sorry about that. That was
wrong. That's a great image. I like that.
That should be a title: Doll in a Cornfield. Why don't we work on a short story together? Doll in a Cornfield. But
and we do need a cornfield episode. And I don't know if you mentioned this, but I remember talking with somebody, and a lot of people find cornfields scary. Period.
Mm.
Which I spent a few years on a farm, so I was okay with cornfields, but.
Well, you got, like, if you think of a title like Children of the Corn, it was like Children of the Asparagus Patch, it may not be as horrifying or scary.
Right.
Yeah. If asparagus is in patch, I'm not sure what it is. I mean, The Great Pumpkin, of course, was a wonderful thing. We may need. Okay, I think I've lost my.
Yeah, agriculture. Agriculture and horror would be a good one. Yeah. But even the Twilight Zone episode with Billy Mummy as Anthony, you know, he doesn't just kill them. He wishes them into the cornfield.
That's right.
You know,
that's
like
right.
A fate the worse cornfield, than death.
Yes, yes, exactly. And there's also the cornfield, of course, in Field of Dreams, which is
a happy
one
cornfield.
Of my favorite films. Yeah, in but that it, case.
But it still represents something beyond life.
Yes.
Well, literally afterlife. But
Yeah.
Yeah, that means you're dead, folks.
Yeah.
Well, that was a fun episode, Dave.
Yeah, I think it worked out very well. So if anyone hasn't seen some of these things, we do recommend it. And certainly that last episode, the children. And what was neat is we were watching this interview by Karen Black about, and I had no idea that she was the one that had suggested the ending with it. I don't want to spoil or anything, but it has been 50 years, but the teeth and everything, because you've got a end scene where you've got Karen Black there with a knife. You don't know what's happened because she's had that fight with the doll. And then there's this break. And then suddenly it's later at night. She's there. It's all dark and she's hitting the ground with that knife, like in a pat, like in a specific kind of pattern.
Yeah.
And then you get her look and then her mouth opening up and the teeth.
And even just the physicality of it, just for folks who don't know, she's basically imagine a catcher in the catching position, you know, squatting down or almost like, because it's almost like she's implying like childbirth, like she's just down there squatting and almost showing everything there. And by the way, we were also, David and I were speculating, we couldn't remember who she had phoned and invited over, but it was her mother said, please. Yeah. Come on over, Mom. Yeah. I can't wait to see you. And then we get this shot of her like this and it's just so intense.
Yeah. And during the interview with maybe it was added stuff on your DVD or whatever, but there's Karen Black talking about, she was the one that had the idea of the teeth at the end. And then I guess it Dan Curtis or whoever said, well, you know, we don't really have the budget, or he thought it was a good idea. And she said, well, she could do it herself. Like, she had some understanding of costume and appliance and various things. Like, she really knew what she was doing. And she said, oh, I'll do that. It won't cost you anything. That's how that got greenlit. Because if it wasn't, it wouldn't have had the same effect at the ending.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just, there's something so disturbing about that. And I did just want to mention to listeners that all three of these movies, Duel, Night Stalker, and Trilogy of Terror, are available to buy on Blu-ray. They can be streamed. And I believe they're all available on YouTube as well. So they're there for the watching, if you so choose. Also, I will mention the wonderful book, The ABC Movie of the Week Companion by Michael Carroll. If you want to sort of refresh your memory on what was dropped and when and who was in these things, it's all in this book. And I think we're ready to say goodbye. And, oh, I guess we're also saying Happy Halloween, aren't we?
Yeah, I think we are. People may not be aware, but we are recording this near the end of July. But we've figure October has always been our horror. It is horror month. And we've been very good about always having some kind of a horror theme. And Richard Matheson is connected very much with the whole horror genre. And I don't think he's one of those people that didn't like that association. Because you can accept it and just say, yeah, you are one. And he influenced people. Like, a lot of his books you see on the cover, you know, how much Stephen King was influenced by him. And of course, everyone, him and everyone else, was influenced by Ray Bradbury. But, you know, it's sort of like paying it forward. You know, we're all trying to scare the hell out of each other. And certainly Richard Matheson was one of the greats.
Yeah, we want to thank everybody, as always, for listening. And you can, we would love it if you told some friends about it, it being the show. And please feel free to, you know, engage with us on our socials. You can go to our website, which is, David?
The numeric 2OF, which is short for Old Farts. .ca.
And you can find us also on our Facebook group, which is simply Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. We'll be posting stuff as always, and we encourage you to chat with us there as well, or post some things, as long as they are both appropriate and appropriate to the genre. We love seeing your posts too. But yeah, please let other folks know about us. Like, share, do all of those wonderful things, and keep coming back, because we love having you around, and we and you are the reason that we do this. So yeah, have a happy Halloween.
Absolutely, happy Halloween, and watch us how much sugar intake that you're both my sisters and brothers and I have both back in the day ended up with 10 or 15 cavities in one session at the dentist. But maybe I've said too much, because that's a whole other scary moment.
Yeah.
But anyways, I'm David Click,
and I am Troy Harkin,
and thank you for listening to Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.
Ooh.
Oh my God, what's Roddenberry's first name? Oh my God, how could I just Gene. Blank on that? I
think Gene.
You're on your own, Dave. It's one old fart from now on.
Gene Roddenberry.
Sorry about that. That's just like, that's the ultimate. We always talked about getting canceled, and I think this is the reason. It's not for the regular reasons. It's like, I'm getting canceled because I forgot Gene Roddenberry's name.
Who should be calling the doctor now? Holy fuck. Yeah. No, just kidding. Yeah. That came out wrong.